Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. Happy International Women's Day. Today on the program, later on, we're going to hear one of the last interviews ever done with novelist Toni Morrison. We're going to hear that in this hour. First up, though, we'll hear Florida This Week. We want to say that all day today, WMNF is devoting a lot of airtime to women. And on the Midpoint program today at 12 noon, Janet Scherberger will interview State Senators Arthenia Joyner and former Education Commissioner Betty Castor and Pat Frank, the former State Senator and Clerk of Courts in Hillsborough County, and also State Representative Fentress Driscoll. They're all coming up on the Midpoint program in the next hour, so stick around. First up, though, today, Florida This Week on 88.5 FM. As you listen back to the program, we want to give you an opportunity to comment about the program, too. We'll tell you how to do that in just a few minutes. Coming up next, the legislature opens its session, and we'll look at some of the top issues that will be decided during the next 2 months. More questions are raised about alleged favoritism in the way the governor has distributed COVID-19 vaccines, and the surprising results of the straw poll at the CPAC convention in Orlando. Our guests are Florida Senate President Wilton Simpson, Mary Ellen Kloss, the Times-Herald Capitol Bureau Chief, Sean Shaw with the group People Over Profits, and Zach Anderson from the Sarasota Herald Tribune, next on Florida This Week. Welcome back. The annual two-month session of the Florida Legislature began this week with the governor's annual State of the State address. The governor laid out an agenda that included saying that the state's fiscal outlook is better than forecast last year. He said Florida's unemployment rate is below the national average. He said he's opposed to cuts in K-12 education. He touted his proposed anti-riot law. He criticized big tech for limiting speech and spoke against ballot harvesting. But DeSantis spent much of his time taking credit for keeping the state mostly open during the year-long COVID crisis. And using the term seniors first, he said Florida has handled the pandemic better than most other states.
Our efforts have saved lives. In fact, 40 states have suffered higher COVID mortality for seniors age 65 and up on a per capita basis than the state of Florida has. And the cases and hospitalizations for seniors in Florida have plummeted as vaccinations have increased. Since January 30th, the number of seniors hospitalized for COVID has declined by 80%, and cases among seniors have declined by 71%. Florida was right to prioritize the elderly. Seniors first works.
But the governor's handling of COVID vaccines is now under scrutiny. This week, more reports came out suggesting that the governor may have shown political favoritism in the way he distributed vaccines. The Miami Herald Tampa Bay Times reported that vaccine priority was given in January to residents of the exclusive Ocean Reef Club on Key Largo. Many major DeSantis donors live there, including one donor who made a $250,000 contribution to DeSantis. DeSantis, though, says a local hospital, not the state government, made the decision on who to vaccinate. It's not the first time the governor's been accused of steering vaccines to wealthier communities. The only Democrat elected to statewide office, Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried, called for a federal investigation.
If this isn't public corruption, I don't know what is. I know that we will get to the bottom of this. So I am asking the FBI Public Corruption Unit to be investigating this.
In order to navigate the pandemic, Governor DeSantis has not allowed the Capitol in Tallahassee to be open to visitors. This comes as he also ordered all businesses to be open in Florida. Mary Ellen Kloss is the co-bureau chief of the Miami Herald Tampa Bay Times in Tallahassee. And Mary Ellen, welcome back to Florida This Week.
Good to be here, Rob.
The first question is there hard evidence that the governor has steered vaccines to wealthier communities in the state? Do we have data?
Well, the problem is we don't have data at all. Florida may be open for business, but we're not open for our records review. And so because the governors and the Department of Health have pretty much kept the criteria for how they select any of these sites for vaccine distribution. There are places where they just do what they're called pop-up distribution spots. There is no way to know whether there's been certain, you know, parts of the state have been given anything other than the anecdotal evidence of favoritism. So the governor wants to say that there is no favoritism, but they have refused to show us where they have provided the vaccines and when. And as a result, we really can't, we have to, it's, you know, a trust, they're asking us to trust their word, but we don't have any proof.
So when the Times and the Herald broke the story this week about the club in Key Largo, the Ocean Reef Club, was it just luck that you got a hold of the information that these, this wealthy enclave got the vaccines?
So we had some readers write in and say, you know, these, I know people, and there were people who are very close, let's just say, to the Ocean Reef Club, and said that they had received vaccines. So we started asking some questions and were able to get a copy of a newsletter that they had written on January 22nd, basically saying that more than 1,200 people who lived there had been vaccinated for at least for the first dose, and they had sufficient supply to give everybody a second dose. Now, this particular clinic is associated with Baptist Healthcare. Baptist Healthcare is the largest hospital chain in the Southeast, and they have clinics all up and down the Southeast coast. But one of the important things is, at the same time, this particular clinic in the at the Ocean Reef Club was giving vaccinations, Baptist Health was also saying its supply was so short, it had to cancel appointments that had been made by the general public. So it's raised a lot of questions, and I'm not saying that there is anything that has been done wrong, but we really have not been given answers.
When Agriculture Commissioner Freed and some other Democrats there in Tallahassee call for a federal investigation, is there any reason to believe that the feds would have something to investigate?
You know, if I think part of their complaint was at the same time that the governor was doing all these vaccination outreach, his campaign was collecting money, or his political committee was collecting money. And in the month of February alone, he raised $2.7 million. There is no evidence that these campaign contributions were part of a pay-for-play scheme. But that is the question that the Democrats are raising. And I think it may be that, you know, it's going to take somebody who's got the powers of law enforcement to get answers if the governor's office and the Department of Health won't give them any.
And that $2.7 million was a lot to raise so far away from the next election. One more question, that is, there's so many big issues in Tallahassee. What are you watching? What's moving forward the fastest? What do you think the public needs to pay attention to?
So there's it's really, there are things that are moving quickly. They're doing some things that, you know, just in the last week, they passed a bill relating to giving immunity to businesses for COVID liability claims. But there's other things that are moving really quickly. And I think it's important for people to keep a look at. You mentioned at the top of the show, the hurdles to vote by mail. Also, there's movement for the way publicly they're creating some new educational savings accounts that will be used for the public, for people to use for private tuition. That could really reframe the way we finance public education in Florida. And so those are really kind of big issues that I think will have long-term implications if they pass the way they're presented right now.
Mary Ellen Kloss, thanks a lot. It's always good to see you. Thank you for coming on Florida This Week.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Senate President Wilton Simpson is a Republican from District 10. He's a Trilby native, and he succeeded another Tampa Bay resident as Senate President, Bill Galvano of Bradenton. He runs an egg farm and an environmental remediation company. And Senate President Wilton Simpson, welcome back to Florida This Week.
thank you for having me, Rob. It's been a while, and as you know how busy we are now, but I'm happy to be back.
I'm so glad you're here. First of all, let me ask you about Nikki Fried, the agriculture commissioner, and other Democrats out up there, Gary Farmer, asking for an investigation into the way the governor has distributed COVID-19 vaccines. What do you think of that?
You know, it's really amazing, Rob, that we would even go down this road. It's completely ridiculous and baseless. And, you know, it's politics. It's Washington-style politics. The governor has done a tremendous job making sure that our most vulnerable had access to the vaccine. 65 and up has been a great policy. You can see other states that are now trying to mimic our policies here. The governor just announced in Pasco County yesterday, day before yesterday, that we were now going to go down to 50 and up for school teachers, law enforcement, with the new vaccine that's out. So we're getting more and more supply, and the governor has got a great plan. And look, this is not by accident. From the very beginning, we protected our most vulnerable, which is why Florida's numbers. And look, one death is too many, and I know we're just a little over 31,000, and that's horrible. But relative to our other states, the state of Florida has done a great job in protecting its most vulnerable, and this governor has led that action. And anything short of that is ridiculous.
And Senator, there's that nagging suspicion, though, that some people in wealthier zip codes have seen better treatment than others. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, to that, I would say that I know the governor has worked with church organizations in African-American neighborhoods, poor neighborhoods all over the state. It's been distributed, widely distributed through supermarkets, whether it's Winn-Dixie or Publix or Walmart. So this has been widely distributed. If you live in a neighborhood where you have a lot of 65-year-old and ups, the governor's office would love to hear from you if we have not been to your neighborhood. I have seen him in action firsthand. We get a report every morning saying what percentage of people in your neighborhood are vaccinated. So if you look at Broward County, for instance, it's well over 60% vaccinated for 65-year-old and ups. That's all of them. Broward County is a pretty blue area of the state. And so Pasco County 3 days ago was only at 42%. So I could make the claim that the governor is prioritizing the Democrats in Broward County over, you know, a Republican county like Pasco. That claim would also be ridiculous. That's the reality of that, Rob.
So let me ask you about some of the legislation. There is the proposal that the governor first made public about heightening the penalties on people that participate in protests that turn violent. My understanding is that maybe Jeff Brandis of St. Petersburg, who heads two important committees there in the Senate, may not be in favor of this. What do you think the status is of the anti-riot bill?
I think the status is that bill will certainly make it to the governor's desk this year. I am not sure, and I said this earlier, but I'm not sure when protecting our law enforcement officers ever became a political football. Doing the right thing. People can peacefully protest all they want. No one is ever going to object to that. We actually would support that 100% as all of our people would. But when it comes to rioting, when it comes to burning and burning people's buildings, destroying property, and certainly attacking our law enforcement, we are going to enhance those penalties and make sure that people know that in Florida that is unwelcome business. And I believe that bill will pass off the Senate floor, and we will end up with a bill on the governor's desk that we can all be proud of.
What happens, though, if you're in a demonstration and somebody, you know, maybe one in a thousand commits a violent act? Doesn't everybody then who participates in that demonstration have to suffer the consequences?
No, that would not be accurate at all. When you looked at the demonstrators, if you go back to the June and July demonstrations and then turned into rioting, 98% of the people that were there were peacefully protesting. There was nothing wrong with that. It was a very small group that was actually committing the crime and destroying property throughout other states, not so much in Florida, but throughout other states. When you look at what happened January the 6th through the same lens, same exact thing, 98% of those folks were there peacefully protesting, and obviously 2% of them created the problem we had there in Washington. Both groups, by the way, of rioters, not protesters, should be held responsible. It was really nice to see that the media in January decided that they would be back on the side of law enforcement and law and order, finally, the national media. It was a shame that, you know, when the rioting and was going on in you know, June and July, they seemed to call that peaceful protesting.
We're down to the last 40 seconds. I have 10 more questions I wish I could ask you, but what's your main priority? As Senate President, you've got a lot of power this year. Tell me what your main priority is to get passed in the session.
The main priority, Rob, is real simple. What I want to do is give children that need to be adopted or in foster care the opportunity to get permanency in their lives much quicker. The sooner if we can get a child by 3 or 4 years old into a permanent situation, they have an 80-year plus opportunity to have a quality of life other than they would not have been able to have. And then number two of that, I would say, which feeds right into it, is give parents more choices to educate their children and to have it make their choice to where they get their child educated. And if you do those things, I think we can finally break generational poverty for once and for all, and we can give parents the power to raise their children.
Senator Wilton Simpson, thanks a lot for coming on Florida This Week. Great to see you.
Thank you. Good seeing you too.
Proposed legislation in Tallahassee would allow homeowners insurance companies to change the way they cover roofs that are more than 10 years old. Senate Bill 76, proposed by Republican Jim Boyd of Bradenton, would change the way a roof is evaluated by the insurance company. Attorney Sean Shaw founded the nonprofit group People Over Profits in 2019 to help fight against corporate influence and for the rights of everyday people. He's a former state legislator from Tampa and made history in 2018 as the Florida Democratic Party's first African-American nominee for attorney general. Sean Shaw, welcome back.
Thank you, Rob. Great to be here, as always.
So let's talk about this bill that would change insurance and the way insurance deals with roofs. What would it do, and why are you concerned about it?
Well, it would essentially, you wouldn't be able to get full price for your roof replaced. It would be depreciated, and an older roof, you would essentially get what the roof had depreciated to. And I don't know what you're going to do with a 50% depreciated roof check. You can't replace your roof with that. You get insurance to replace your roof and replace things when you need them done. I don't get insurance so that I can get half a roof. That's not what we do insurance for. But, you know, I've been kind of dealing with insurance even before I got into the Florida House. And it's just shocking to me that the industry the sky is always falling. Rates are always having to go up because of fraud or lawyers or claims or this and that. I've never heard a year where the insurance industry says, you know what, everything was all right, we're going to lower rates. Never. You never hear the other side of that coin. You always hear the sky is falling, and it's every single year for some reason. It's always some boogeyman. Sometimes it's lawyers. Sometimes it's too many claims. Sometimes it's this. Sometimes it's that. Well, another thing is, we always assume the best intentions from insurance companies up in Tallahassee, but we always assume the worst intentions from people that make claims and people that defend people that make claims. So it's just tough, and it's the same story every year.
So this bill, in your mind, would be very dangerous to people that are living on fixed incomes. They've already paid off their house, and they pay their insurance every year. But if they get hurricane damage, this bill could be a problem for them.
If I've got a roof that's, you know, 8 years old and a hurricane messes it up to the point I need a new roof, my insurance company now is going to give me a check that is going to be depreciated as to whatever an 8-year-old roof costs. Now, how am I going to replace a roof with 8-year-old roof money? That is not what I'm paying my premium for. But, you know, there's other things in here that it shortens the time that you can make a claim. It tries to go after lawyers as well. It's just, every year, Rob, there's some sort of legislation like this, and there's always a boogeyman. The consumer is always taken on the chin when it comes to insurance.
I want to ask you about the reports that the governor may have shown political favoritism in distributing vaccines around the state. Do you think that's going to be a problem for the governor?
The more I see about this, the more I'd be concerned if I was him, whether it's the Florida Keys, whether it's somewhere in Sarasota or Manatee. We keep seeing instances of very wealthy neighborhoods getting access And we also heard in the Keys or somewhere in South Florida, they opened up a vaccination place in an African-American neighborhood. But guess who was coming in to get the shot? It was the wealthy people from down the street that were getting access to the actual shots, regardless of where the location was. So I'm very concerned that these gated communities are getting access. At a minimum, the governor needs to explain what's going on there. But I think where there's smoke, there's fire. And there's enough of these instances of these wealthy enclaves getting access to the vaccine that, you know, this is not vaccine by capitalism. This ought to be transparent. It ought to be equitable. It ought to be fair. And right now, it certainly doesn't seem like it.
Sean Shaw, thanks for coming on Florida This Week. I wish we had more time, but please come back.
Always. Thank you.
In a speech to the Conservative Political Action Committee in Orlando last weekend, former President Donald Trump repeated false claims of election theft. He also declared that he is considering another presidential run in 2024. Zach Anderson is the political editor at the Sarasota Herald Tribune, and he's been covering the events. And Zach, welcome back to Florida This Week.
Thanks for having me.
Let's take a look at the straw poll that was taken at CPAC last weekend. This has Donald Trump with a 55% preference among the people who attended to run for president again. Then Ron DeSantis comes in with 21%. That's a pretty good showing. And our U.S. Senator Rick Scott comes in with less than 1%. Tell me, what's your take on that poll?
Well, two things. One, that, you know, Trump obviously still has a lot of support among Republicans. You know, this is, you got to take the poll with a little bit of a grain of salt, because it is, you know, just a poll of people at one political conference. So, I mean, it's not like a representative slice of the Republican Party, but these are people who are very in tune. They're influencers. And, you know, this poll does get quite a bit of attention. So it does show that obviously Trump still has support among Republicans, and it shows that Ron DeSantis is having a bit of a moment here right now. You know, he's been very aggressive in his rhetoric concerning the coronavirus pandemic and, you know, being very much against lockdowns, very much in favor of keeping things open, limiting restrictions on businesses, opposing a mask mandate here in Florida. So it seems like that is resonating with conservative voters right now, with conservative activists. You looked at the poll that shows that includes Trump, but they actually did a poll that didn't include Trump, and DeSantis was leading in that poll. He was getting 43% with the South Dakota governor, Kristi Noem, far behind him. So he is having a bit of a political moment here, and it does seem to be based a lot around his coronavirus policies.
You and other reporters around the state have been pointing out, though, that in Ron DeSantis's pop-up vaccine programs around the state, a lot of these programs end up going to wealthy communities, and those wealthy communities also contain a lot of donors and supporters of Ron DeSantis. Could it come back to haunt him if it's shown that he's shown favoritism for the elites?
Yeah, you know, the governor does continue to face plenty of questions about his pandemic response, you know, and if you look at it, you know, public health professionals have questioned things like him not instituting a mask mandate. There are plenty of concerns that remain among, you know, a number of voters. But maybe the biggest issue for him right now are these pop-up vaccine clinics and whether the vaccines are being fairly distributed to people, because that is something that people are watching very closely. You know, these vaccines are a hot commodity. They're a life-saving drug. They're vitally important, and people want them to be handed out fairly. You know, there's not enough vaccine to go around right now. You know, the supply is getting better, and you know, we're seeing it ramp up more and more, but you know, especially early on, there was very limited vaccine and a ton of people who wanted this. And so these pop-up clinics where certain communities got special access where only residents in those communities or only residents in a handful of communities could get access to this vaccine, and they were basically allowed to move to the front of the line while everybody else had to wait. They've raised some questions about whether the pop-up clinics have gone to communities that had political connections that were developed by donors to the governor or had other connections that allowed them to be favored to get these vaccines. And that is a concern amongst a lot of people who want to see these vaccines distributed fairly and everybody have an equal shot.
Zach, one last question. We only have 40 seconds, but Rick Scott is in the bottom, either if in a head-to-head matchup with Donald Trump or in an open field. Rick Scott got very low numbers. He's got a very high profile. He's on Fox all the time. Why such low numbers? And we only have 30 seconds.
Well, I think, you know, the pandemic is the big issue right now. So voters are really paying attention to the governors who have much more control over pandemic policies. Rick Scott, even though he is known here in Florida, I don't think he's as nationally known as Governor DeSantis has become during this pandemic. But you can't underestimate Scott. You know, people have been doing that for a long time, and he's won three elections. He is very wealthy. He's used his money to get his name out there, and he certainly seems to be ambitious going forward. So we'll see. It's quite possible that he could put himself in the mix regardless of where he stands right now.
Zach Anderson, always great to see you. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, that was Florida This Week from this past Friday night on WEDU-TV, the PBS station here in the Tampa Bay area that also covers Sarasota and Brooksville and Polk County, too. My guest on that program, Zach Anderson, a reporter with the Sarasota Herald Tribune, Sean Shaw, former state representative from Tampa, a Democrat, Senator Wilton Simpson, the current Florida Senate President, a Republican, and Mary Ellen Kloss, the Capitol Bureau Chief for the Tampa Bay Times. And if you want to comment about the show, because it's International Women's Day, we're not going to take phone calls today live, but what we'll do is take your comments on the comment line, which is 813-238-8001. And you can record your comment on extension 115. Lots of interesting things said there during the last 25 minutes or so. So if you want to comment about anything you've heard there, you can call us at 813-238-8001 and leave your message on extension 115. And I'll play those comments back tomorrow. Right now, in honor of International Women's Day, we're going to hear one of the greatest authors that America has produced, Toni Morrison. She did an interview with KPFA, the community radio station in Northern California a few years ago. Last month would have been Toni Morrison's 90th birthday, but she passed away in 2019. We're going to hear an interview that Margaret Prescott did late in Toni Morrison's life. And Toni Morrison, of course, the author of many books, including Song of Solomon, Beloved, Jazz, and God Help the Child. And we're going to hear this really incredible interview that Margaret did with Toni Morrison next here on 88.5 FM in honor of International Women's Day.
Sex, race, and class, it's all there in Toni Morrison's latest novel, Love. It is brilliant, moving, simple, yet complex storytelling that is riveting as it is beautiful. It is a view into a slice of the Black community during the pre- and post-civil rights period that also reflects society as a whole. It is an intersection of art and politics so hard to achieve successfully, yet I think achieved in love. The range, depth, and clarity of the characters and the insight into how the influences on human behavior and how the divisions among us are played out in day-to-day living are beautifully reflected in love. We're delighted to welcome to Morning Review, the Sojourner Truth Edition, Black woman writer, Nobel Prize laureate, and Pulitzer Prize winner, Toni Morrison. Ms. Morrison, you have a huge fan base in our audience. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, this is a pleasure for me.
Oh, very good. I must ask you at the start, it has been reported that you have said many Black writers write for a white audience. Would you care to comment on that? And, do you include yourself in that? Did you even say that?
Yeah, I said it. But what I meant was, It doesn't matter who reads the book. You write for the widest audience you can garner. What I meant was, in the reading of a number of particularly early on books by black writers, I, as a reader, could sense that they were addressing their remarks to a non-black audience because that was, I suppose, the confrontation. A simple example, the book I love a lot and admire the author a lot, Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man. Well, the title gives it away, this awareness of the gaze of a white reader, because that character is not invisible to me, to a black person.
Yes.
He's invisible in the outside world. So it's the outside world that the narrator is addressing or editorializing for or explaining for, just, you know, in an absolutely flawless way. But when you read other black writers, sometimes you get the feeling, or I do, that they're explaining things that I know. I mean, every black person would not need to be told these
right.
things. So let's, you know, that was just a difference, I think, a shift in perhaps contemporary African-American writing from earlier writing, that's all.
Yes, so you think that has changed today?
I think so.
Yes.
I think the voice is so obviously directed within the community, and some people thought that meant that if you're writing as specifically as you can and carefully as you can within the community, that that is an exclusionary tactic, when it's just the opposite. It's when you know your material and it pleases yourself as a reader and readers like you, then other people from other cultures have access to it because of its specificity.
Yes, absolutely. Now, you have referred to race as the heart of democracy, and you have described race as the canvas of your new book, Love. Would you care to comment on that?
Well, there are very few things that you could talk about in this country that does not have race and racism as its underground, sometimes on the ground subject. If you talk about the public school system, that's what you're talking about. If you talk about healthcare, that's what you're talking about. If you talk about the prison system, that's really what you're talking about. If you talk about labor law, that's what you're talking about.
Right.
I mean, there's virtually nothing that you can say, because the history of apartheid and separation and denigration is so deeply ingrained in not just the body politic, but the minds of blacks and whites, that it's very difficult. You can't extricate it. And, you know, everything. I mean, what the last election, or the question of voting rights, or the question of full citizenship, or the question of representation. I mean, all of those things can only be addressed completely and honestly when you are addressing racial problems. What's affirmative action about? It certainly isn't about women being offered places in the university because they are women and have been repressed, and therefore need a wider open door. I don't hear any women complaining about affirmative action.
Uh-huh.
It's only blacks who bear the brunt of that argument. They are the ones who may be getting something for nothing or being given special treatment, which is understood to be, quote, unfair, unquote.
Yes. Now, it's interesting that you said that, because I wanted to ask you about women, because you do deal with women a lot. You have said that you like outlaw women, and certainly your new novel Love is full of them, but also your other books from The Bluest Eye to Sula, Beloved, and more. And in Love, you have a range of outlaw women, including a mysterious lead character who happens to be but one of the prostitute women in the story. What is it about outlaw women? Tell us about that.
Well, I guess it's a fascination for someone outside the border, so to speak, a daring woman. They generally come to a bad and weeping end in traditional literature.
That's true.
Because they are, if they do something anarchic, they are beaten back or they die or what have you. And sometimes what they do is terrible and has consequences, you know, that might justify their pain. Nevertheless, as a writer, it's that person who pushes the envelope, who says no, who says, I'm not doing it that way. And whether they win or lose, you know, Beloved was a woman who said no, I am not letting my children go back to slavery. Or it may be some other form of, you know, battle. But they, for me, it just opens the door to other kinds of consideration. And, you know, my life is very humdrum, so maybe that's another reason why I'm very interested in these women who just, you know, say no and stand up and take it on and run with it.
Yeah, I mean, you say you deal with race, but it seems to me as though you also address the issue of sex and sexism quite well. I was quite struck in reading Love, your new novel, with your understanding of how the work of women, often invisible background type work, even the work you may describe as humdrum, but that it keeps things going and that it often makes men look good.
Right.
Yeah, and one character described the work of herself and a woman who later lost her mind as, quote, the two of us were like the back of a clock. What a wonderful way to describe essential work.
Yeah, he was the face. Well, those things are intertwined for me, race and gender, because you have the two, you know, categories of people who had to fight and struggle for even the smallest things, let alone, you know, opportunities to fulfill themselves completely. And it's in Love I really wanted to expose, describe, and explore the gamut of the various kinds of love, and especially, of course, various kinds of the ways in which women love each other and how they, what you said before about how they relate to Bill Cozy, the man who sort of is the center of their lives or the void of their lives, is because in many instances, women give men that power and ascribe him all those roles of friend, father, lover, benefactor, what have you. And the men take it, I suppose, or don't take it or refuse it. But what was true, I think, about those women, at least I hope it was clear, is that it was only until they could sort of exorcise him, you know, the last chapter called
yes.
Phantom,
yes.
that they sort of find out who they were. It's true that he manipulated their lives and ruined some of them, but they were complicit in it in a way. All they wanted to do was who did he love most, who did he ruin fast, what, you know, that constant cycle of we were his victim, and they're fighting over his legacy. Nobody just said, oh, well, forget about it.
Yes, and to really give the broadest view of love, it addresses a number of things. I mean, you do talk about love and the way women love each other and all of what you described. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM in Southern California, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. You're listening to the Sojourner Truth edition of Morning Review, and we're having a discussion with the Black woman author and Pulitzer Prize winner, Toni Morrison. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. We'll be right back.
And you're listening to this interview with Toni Morrison on WMNF 88.5 FM on International Women's Day.
Tonight at 7 p.m.
So this is an interview that took place in 2003 with Toni Morrison.
Beginning at 8 a.m.
We're hearing the announcements about the upcoming programs there on the West Coast. But let's go back and hear more of this interview with Toni Morrison here on International Women's Day on 88.5 FM.
Through the years, you've been listening to history. Now, listen to her story. Feminist Magazine. Hi, I'm Desiree Vanderwaal with Feminist Magazine. Listen Wednesday night from 7 until 8 o'clock on KPFK 90.7 FM, Pacifico Radio.
Yeah, the sound of promos from community radio on the West Coast.
To the Sojourner Truth edition of Morning Review, and we're having a discussion with Toni Morrison about her new book, Love. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Now, your story is based around a Black-owned resort that some have equated with a Black-owned resort in American Beach, Florida. And the case has been made that the civil rights movement that opened the door for integration was in part responsible for the demise of a sector of Black-owned businesses in the Black community when segregation existed. Do you think there has been a demise, or has there been a shift of that sector? And what do you think that has meant for those who have been left behind, so to speak, in the inner city areas or the parts that are primarily still primarily Black and other people of color?
Well, there are a number of consequences of the civil rights movement. I just didn't want it to appear so simple that everybody just jumped on the wagon and said, let's go.
Yeah.
Because there were people who were frightened of it and alarmed by it, and they were people who had gone to those really first-rate Black schools, and they had gone to Howard University's Law School or School of Architecture or to Meharry Medical School, or were entrepreneurs, and they serviced a fairly captive audience, which were other Black people. And they were people that people were proud of, you know, the race men, they were called, or race women. And they, but the interesting thing is that they sort of had to live together, you know, on the same street. The doctor lived next door to the, I don't know, sanitation worker who lived next door to the barber. So that there, the class division was not so overwhelming. You could see them. Then here comes the civil rights movement, which was absolutely necessary and absolutely important. But it had some losses. People could then go vacation someplace else, or go to some other school, or move into other neighborhoods. And all I am suggesting is that that kind of leap forward progress, however difficult it was, has a loss. You pay a price for it. Every group that came to this country did. We just did it belatedly. You know, there are people who have told me that when the schools were integrated in their part of, a small town in the South, what happened was that the best Black teachers left and went to the white school.
Yes.
And then we had years, you know, decades of Black schools begging for money. They have revitalized themselves since then. But there was a drain from schools that had these first-rate reputations because other schools were vying for that population, or students could choose whether to go, you know, to one place or another. So I just wanted to complicate that story a little bit, because I think some of it is still flopping around, those questions, that debate, in the contemporary world.
Yes, and in fact, I did want to ask you about that. I mean, it's wonderful, in fact, that you addressed it. I mean, in Love, several, if not all, the sectors, frankly, on the economic scale of society are represented, from those who live in dire poverty, from a place you call in the book the settlement, to factory workers, to maids, to cooks, to prostitutes, to owners, and the clash and the interrelationship of those sectors. I mean, you show tremendous tremendous insight into the point of view of all of these sectors, and you also show some sympathy for them. I wanted to just raise with you to just compare that to what is happening in the Black world today, in the Black community today. Do you see a change? Do you see, I think from your previous answer, you're saying the sectors in some cases are further apart than they had been, and that this has been part of the impact of what is now a greatly expanded Black middle class.
Yeah, which moved out.
Yeah.
Moved someplace else. And left those neighborhoods for the people, you know, who had the fewest and the least resources. The lawyers may still practice in those communities. They don't live there. But the problem for me was either or. If you chose integration and assimilation, why did that necessarily mean that you couldn't have the resources in Black communities at the same time?
That yes.
Did you have to integrate, or could you just bring the money into the schools where they were? Did you have to, you know, it was never an either-or situation. For me, it looked like there was one road only, and which we took, which was taken, and that had some, you know, peril involved in it. And we can still see the, you can still see it, you know, in neighborhoods. The authenticity of the race culturally comes from the street. But the execution of the cultural forces in the academy, et cetera, is assimilated. You have to transfer those cultural icons and mores and folklore into something else so that you have people who study Black people, I mean Blacks who study other Blacks.
Yes.
In order to say this is what it is, which is, I'm not denigrating any of this, I'm just talking about the shift. But I think now there's also a call or an awareness of that part of the cultural life of the Black community that one lost, that we lost. Even in the more radical days of the civil rights movement, there were people who were Black nationalists who were screaming for exactly what Bill Cozy had, Black businesses, Black patronizing each other, living separately from white people, I mean choosing to live separately from white people, having your own stuff. But during the height of the movement, there was the other side of it, which was also, you know, assimilation. It's a very complex thing, and I think it is the main theme of the acquisition of full democratic rights in this country. It can always be viewed through the glass, the magnifying glass, when you look at what happens to Black people.
Yes, it's interesting that you have said that. A few weeks ago, I spoke with the Caribbean author George Lamming, who wrote that wonderful book, In the Castle of My Skin.
Right.
Yes, and one of the things he talked about in referring to the growing middle class in the Caribbean region, he was frankly a bit critical, and he said, listen, there's a kind of a moral bankruptcy going on, and that this is contributing to some of the problems that we're having with our youth now. And we know that there is a tension between and within the Black community. I know we don't like to talk about it that much, but it does exist between that middle class and between those with the least, with the grassroots. And you actually addressed this tension and love in the wonderful storytelling way that you have. So from what you're saying, you do think that it is a significant thing to address in the Black community. And I wondered if you observed this kind of shift going on as you were growing up and developing in Lorraine, Ohio, or something that
so many thousands of years ago. It hadn't happened then.
Right.
Until course, everybody that I knew at Lorraine was dirt poor, but I think it was one doctor. He lived sort of around the corner. We didn't socialize with them, but I think there were other reasons for that. But I do remember it being very distinctive in when I was in college, you know, when I went away to school, which was, you know, in the 50s and then began to see it rapidly in the late 50s, or at least the situation in which you could talk about people who were in my socioeconomic class as a kid as them. I mean, I was a them.
Right.
But, you know, money does that. And this country is, you know, class ridden. It doesn't like to talk about it because they've always been able to say black people instead of poor people. But in fact, that is a very big matter here. And the only way you can show that you are, you have arrived is not necessarily by education, but for other people, it's just the acquisition of things. You know, you just buy stuff. And that gives you, you know, sort of feeling that, you know, you crossed the line somewhere.
Yes, so that brings us, that buying stuff brings us to, there's a character in Love named Dark Cosey, who in fact was the father, I think, of Bill Cosey, who was the main character. And this Dark Cosey, and interesting that you chose that name, he was adept at accumulating wealth. In fact, he made money during the Great Depression, and it was actually described as part of a long line of black folks going back to slavery that was into that kind of accumulation. And Dark is not a sympathetic character.
No, he's a traitor. He's a stooge.
Yeah.
Stooge. That story they told about how wonderful they were was all fantasy with Bill Cosey's family. The truth was that his father did have a lot of money, earned it, but he earned it in, you know, a nefarious way. There used to be, and they probably are now, not quite informants, but people who white establishment figures can count on to tell them what's going on, who was hiding in the neighborhood,
right,
who had done, you know, and he was paid for that service. And that's informing, not because you have to or somebody's threatening you or because, you know, there's something in exchange, but that's money. And that money was so bloody and so soiled. So his son, who inherits it, decides to do just the opposite and have this fabulous resort and classy entertainers and women and men who came were, you know, the creme de la creme, and let everybody have fun. That was his plan. Well, of course, you know, things do go awry.
Things do go awry. And you also, though, even with Bill Cosey, in the book, you do show that there was a time that he actually refused a request on the part of some members of the black community to, I think, sell some land or something and made another kind of deal. So even though he tried to do the opposite of his father, it seemed as though there was still a little of the chip off the old block left.
Jump on that right away, although I think his wife, by the time he was old then and probably didn't care, I think he'd had a lot to do with that. But there is a character in the book whom I liked. Her name is Vida, married to Sandler.
Yes.
And they represented for me a kind of norm, a nice couple, warm but stern and very much aware of their grandson. And she says at one point something that was sort of interesting, which is, she disagrees with her husband about this. She says if he had given that land, they would have had some karate places and some art places and some, you know, health food store.
Right.
But they wouldn't have had any houses, which is what happened to that property. It was developed by somebody, HUD money, into living quarters and took them out of the swamps. So there were even two sides to that.
Well, that's an interview that was done in 2003 with the great novelist Toni Morrison. Margaret Prescott did the interview for the community radio station in Berkeley, California. That came out in 2003, that interview, about the time that the novel Love came out. Toni Morrison would have been 90 last month had she lived, but she passed away in 2019. And we're celebrating International Women's Day here on WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. In the next hour, Janet Scherberger will feature some political trailblazers, several Democrats who are women who have won office, some of the top offices in the state of Florida. So she'll feature those interviews in the next hour. You're listening to 88.5 FM. This is WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota, and Lakeland. Coming up next, the news. Thanks to Frank Knox for working behind the scenes to making sure that this program is successful. Here's the news from NPR.